And good morning. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday, July 2nd. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie on the local news hour this morning. It's 51 degrees in Old Town Park City, currently 59 in Heber, with some potential showers and thunderstorms on the way. With more on the weather, here's a report from ABC meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Wednesday, Wasatch Back. It's time for your forecast as we go throughout your Wednesday. We're going to be looking at partly cloudy skies. Temperatures slightly cooler today thanks to the extra clouds and the chance of afternoon scattered showers and storms developing once again across the area. High temperatures in Park City will be into the mid-80s this afternoon, with high temperatures in the upper 80s to low 90s for our friends in the Heber Valley. Again, watch out for some of those scattered showers and storms. They could produce some heavy downpours, some gusty winds, and also the potential of some lightning, which could lead to some other issues, especially if that lightning mixes with some dry vegetation. So be aware of that as we go throughout the day. Otherwise, as we go into your Thursday, we're looking at, again, a chance of those pop-up showers and storms in the afternoon. Otherwise, partly cloudy skies. Temperatures even cooler than your Wednesday, with highs on Thursday only in the mid to upper 70s for Park City and highs in the low to mid 80s for us in the Heber Valley. Once we get towards your Friday, though, the 4th of July right now looking mainly dry across the area with partly cloudy skies. We'll see temperatures for highs climbing to near 80 degrees in Park City, with highs in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. Heading into the rest of your holiday weekend, Saturday will feature plenty of sunshine, low 80s for Park City, with highs in the mid to upper 80s for the Heber Valley. And we'll stay in the mid-80s for high temperatures in Park City for your Sunday, with lots of sunshine and high temperatures in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. It will continue to warm up heading into the beginning of next week, though, with lots of sunshine. High temperatures will be into the mid to upper 80s in Park City, and we'll see those high temperatures in the Heber Valley into the low to mid 90s as we go into your Monday. And we'll stay that way with upper 80s to near 90 for Park City on your Tuesday. Highs will be in the mid-90s for us in the Heber Valley. Again, mainly sunny skies with high pressure in control. That means mainly dry conditions. But if you're making your plans for the 4th of July right now, looks like we're going to have some great weather for those fireworks, firing up the grill, or just getting out on the lake or going for a hike. The weather should cooperate. That's your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Thank you, Cedric. And air quality monitors in the Wasatch Back range between acceptable and satisfactory this morning. Well, coming up later in the program, we'll be speaking with Summit County's Community Development Director, Peter Barnes. He'll have an update on development projects throughout the county, and then we'll check in with North Summit Fire about fire restrictions and fireworks safety this 4th of July. Then it's KPCW's birthday today. We'll be checking in with former program director Jen Williams and current program director John Burdick. Then founder of Kept Current and Kept Kind and KPCW DJ Karen Bell has details on her weekend-long celebration of kindness, community, and connection. One Colville City Council member tried to shut down a 300-acre annexation at the council's most recent meeting last week. The rest of the city's leadership wants to keep talking with the developer. The proposed 300-acre annexation would be home to Hidden Meadow, a 75-unit neighborhood south of Main Street behind the Red Hills subdivision. Representatives for developer Larry H. Miller Real Estate had a discussion about it with the Colville City Council June 23rd. They said they didn't need a decision that day, but Councilmember Louise Willoughby said she was prepared to make a motion to not accept the annexation petition.
As some of the community members have talked to me, one of the visuals that made the most sense to me, it was kind of a funny one, but they said, you let the head of the camel in the tent, it's not long before the whole body's there.
The petition is the document that begins the annexation process, which ends when the council votes to either approve or deny the annexation. So Willoughby was asking not to begin the process at all, but no one seconded her motion.
It looks like, you know, at least the majority of the council would like to just continue the discussion in our next meeting.
That's Mayor Mark Marsh. Hidden Meadow is basically a downsized version of the Cedar Crest Village. That was an application for potentially 2,000 units of housing on about 1,000 acres around Hoytsville to be phased in over decades. It stalled at the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission last year. In Hidden Meadow, project manager Cameron Jackson says 166 acres of hillside would remain open space. The rest of the 300-acre property would get divided into 75 single-family home lots. The company held an open house May 13th at the Ledger's Event Center to speak with current residents about the plans. City leaders attended too. Here's Councilmember Sean Powis.
This idea of bringing more commerce to Main Street was a big issue with the constituents that talked to me at that event.
Jackson says the developer's goal is to support downtown Colville with both commerce and taxes.
We're adding through this development more customers from a retail perspective.
And Larry H. Miller projects a $90,000 annual tax surplus for Colville with the new residents. Council members were skeptical, and Jackson acknowledged residential development doesn't usually pay its own way if there isn't commercial built along with it. But he says the homes will range in value from $700,000 up to $2 million on quarter-acre to one-acre lots. And he says that allows the city to collect more in property taxes without having to maintain as many roads, water, sewer, and the services homes require. The next city council meeting is scheduled for July 14th. And Utah liquor store patrons who agreed to round up to the nearest dollar have helped raise more than $1.5 million for unsheltered services in the state. KUER reports customers agreed to round up in 36% of transactions since the program launched last November. The Utah Department of Workforce Services says the micro donations of 20 to 50 cents at a time go to the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Account. The Atkinson Fund supports homeless services statewide, including emergency shelter, case management, and meals. This first batch of funding will help support winter overflow needs, adding 900 winter shelter beds in Salt Lake County. So far, no end date for the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services and Office of Homeless Service Program has been announced. The program is on track to raise $2 million every year. On the phone with me now is the top planning official for Summit County, Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you. I like that we have a traditional first question with you every time. Any new development applications cross your desk recently?
I like to be able to say pretty much every time. Nothing exciting. Yes, we have applications coming on a fairly regular basis, but nothing that the general population should get too excited about right now. It seems to be a slow time of year. People coming in with minor applications, house extensions, small houses, driveways on steep slopes, etc. Just the usual run-of-the-mill. Nothing to get too excited about. The exciting projects are those ongoing projects we've been talking about for some time, but nothing to get excited about this month.
All right. Well, do you have a peak time of year when you get a lot of applications generally?
Every time the weather changes, every time the snow melts, people rush through the door to try and get building permits. And every time the snow falls, people rush through the door to try and get building permits. From the planning perspective, we actually tend to spend a lot of time on the larger projects during what we see as the downtime on the building permit application. There's always a rush of projects from the planning department side. The high activity in frequent small-scale building permits doesn't cause a bit of a problem. Currently, though, the building department obviously are running around ragged because it's nice, warm, sunny weather, so everyone is out there, you know, nailing studs together and building like crazy.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing I wrote about, I think this was last week, is the Planning Commission made a positive recommendation to you or a recommendation to you on those two new buildings in the Quarry Village area of Lower Pine Brook there. Have you approved those, or did you find something that merited denying them?
No, the first one, that was a fairly simple one. There was a little tweak from a technical side of one of those, but the first one you talked about, they're both actually essentially spec-built shell buildings, you know, commercial buildings that will have tenant fit-outs to follow. The first one from about a month ago, that was just an easy approval. The second one, as you pointed out in your little report, the Planning Commission made a recommendation requesting some architectural changes to be approved by myself, which is very noble of them to give me that authority, of course. But the architect for the project and our senior planner on that project, Amir Chaush, they've gone back to have a quick discussion about what possible changes that they might want to make before it sits across my desk for a signature. So I haven't done anything with that one yet. I fully expect it to go forward with an approval without too much of a hiccup, but I know they're taking another look at it to see what they can do to tweak some of the aesthetics of it.
All right. Yeah, I mean, that's generally the expectation that I have, too, because, you know, your own staff see these applications, then it goes to Planning Commission, depending on the type of permit, and then it goes to you. Have there been any times that you felt like earlier in the process somebody missed something and you've had to deny one of these permits?
No, we rarely deny. We rarely deny at all. We actually spend so much time in advance analyzing projects, going through codes. If something meets code, it gets a permit. That's just a flat out legal obligation. If people are entitled to have something, you know, we talk amongst ourselves as staff. If they're entitled to have it, they get it. If we can find a way to approve it, we will do that. If there's a red flag or an obstacle, it actually rarely gets to Planning Commission. Every now and again, there are projects where we need some input, we need some wider interpretation of some of the rules and some guidance, and where the Planning Commission is the final land use authority, obviously they get to make a decision. If something is denied at the Planning Commission, it would be appealed to Council. If something goes to Planning Commission for a recommendation that would be approved or denied by me, and they tend to be the much smaller projects, I've never denied anything. Because usually it's the all the problems have been ironed out during the analysis stage.
That makes sense. It's a decent segue into the next topic I wanted to touch on, which was the Dakota Pacific real estate application, because that's generally the process. It eventually goes to the manager as the final land use authority, but that's generally the administrative process that this new state law passed earlier this year has mandated for the county. I know that your department has received that administrative application. Any updates with how you've been processing it, and have you been able to forward it to planning commissioners yet?
It is actually timetabled for a hearing in front of the Planning Commission on July the 8th. That the Planning Commission, as you said, this is an administrative process. It's a long and complex story with lots of emotion attached to it. I like to think that this is a simple chapter in it, which should not attract as much attention as it possibly will, in the fact that the process that went through last year with County Council obviously raised a lot of heat, emotion, and opinions. There was the referendum petition filed against it, but the administrative process that's now going to go in front of the Planning Commission, it's essentially, not identical, but it's essentially exactly the same proposal that's been rewritten in an administrative form. And the reason why it's an administrative form is because the state actually stepped in and said, in terms of zoning, the uses, the density, the allowed use, the height, the setbacks, the degree of control have actually been fixed by the state. So what the Planning Commission will be asked to do is look at it from that pure perspective of, does this meet the requirements for an administrative development agreement? The contents of the plan are actually not really on the table during this exercise. So if it meets the criteria for an approvable development agreement, that will then go to the county manager, and the manager will hold a public hearing. And in fact, as recently as yesterday, and this is a, you know, forewarning heads up, we actually have a meeting scheduled for July the 28th in front of the county manager, where he will actually be holding a public hearing. But those notices have yet to be sent out or published. We're going to go to the Planning Commission on July the 8th. They're just going to run through, dot the I's, cross the T's, make sure it meets the criteria to move up to the county manager. And that's where the manager will hold a public hearing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the Dakota Pacific process for the past 5 years has been controversial. I think a fair amount of people, and it's fair to say thousands at this point after that referendum effort, concerned about adding additional housing to the area. And it's already a pretty heavily trafficked area of the county. What, if any, changes at all could happen at the Planning Commission level? Because with those Quarry Village buildings we mentioned, I mean, they were able to request some architectural changes. Could we see, like, a similar little edits here and there, and would it amount to much?
Not within the four corners of this document. Interestingly enough, the substantive tweak from the, if I can call it that, from the county approved, or the council, sorry, approved amended agreement last December to this one, is actually a reduction of 5 residential units and a corresponding 5,000 square feet less built density proposed, which within the 890 to 885 units, you know, and the, you know, 300 to 400,000 or 350,000 square feet of commercial development, it's actually not a lot of changes between the two. The administrative proposal doesn't do anything with that, but what the development agreement does require in the future is that within 45 days of this amendment being approved, a set of architectural guidelines will have to be approved by the Planning Commission. So the Planning Commission will get those reviews, bites of the cherry, as it were, later on down the line when individual projects come through. What this document and this development agreement is doing is setting up the parameters. It's the enabling document, as it were, that allows individual projects to come forward. At that time, the Planning Commission will take on much more of their traditional role. They do have a role in setting up the architectural expectations. There are certain limits within in those powers, but they do actually get to have a say in how this thing should actually work, how it should play out. But the massing, the density, the setback, the height, etc., is governed by the state mandated rules. So the overall form and massing, the structure and grain, as it were, of the project is set. The details, the appearance, the landscaping, everything else that we traditionally look at with those smaller projects will come into play later on.
All right. And listeners might remember that the agreement was originally, not originally, but they passed an identical document at the, or near identical document at the Summit County Council in December before residents asked to overturn that in a referendum petition. Part of that document had the Dakota Pacific Development get tied to UDOT's proposed changes and theoretically improvements to Kimball Junction traffic flow. I remember you said on the program a month or two ago that your office wanted some clarification on that section of this new kind of rewritten and reworded document. Did you get what you were looking for? What exactly were you looking for?
I'm comfortable with it, but obviously I'm just one voice in this conversation and a minor one at that. Transportation Director, Carl Miller, he'll be actually coming in to talk with me today, and we're going to go through some of these finals. The difference between the council document and this document is they've actually taken the phasing of the proposal from 7 phases to 6 phases. There's also a slight tweak in the when we first approved it, when the county council first approved it, they were tied to some very specific published dates and information by UDOT and the work they're going to be doing with Kimball Junction and 224. At the time, there was a lack of clarity. I don't want to make it sound too confusing, but a certain lack of clarity about when certain work programs that UDOT would be responsible for would be available to the public. We've since found out that orderly flow of events from UDOT isn't so orderly as we thought. Dakota Pacific have been back. They've talked to UDOT. When do we get what information? So there's been a slight adjustment as to which units get when and what are the triggering factors, because one or two of the triggering factors from UDOT that we assumed would take place last December is not actually going to happen. So we can't tie a development to a set of processes that no longer exist, so we have some clarification on that. I don't see it as being too controversial. But there's probably going to be, a brief discussion about it, if not at the Planning Commission level, definitely probably at the manager level, and we'll have some technical input from our transportation staff on that one too.
Yeah, previously you being a developer has not been able to go through the administrative process for a development agreement in Summit County. It's only been legislative, meaning they need a council vote, but you've created this process temporarily because state law says you have to. I think it was in place for 6 months to a year. I believe 6 months might have been the max. Have any other developers tried to go for this process besides DPRE?
No. We had a few people query it and look curiously at it. But the way that a temporary zoning ordinance is allowed to be passed by any county, usually for a set of what we would classify as emergency conditions, and they're only allowed to be valid for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, the code returns to what it was previously, or we look to establish a permanent set of rules and regulations in between. There's actually been no outright demand, and part of it is because the very narrow focus of what we call SB 26, you know, the state mandated rezone, was very specific about how and why this particular project would be approved in its format. And because it was so narrowly tailored, it doesn't really apply to anything else. Now, if in the future we find a reason to recreate this administrative process for another reason, then maybe this will actually form the backbone of that code. The administrative development agreement is essentially the same as the legislative development agreement, but there's obviously language regarding legislative actions, administrative actions, who the final land use authorities are or are not. And it's really essentially it's government red tape. It's fulfilling a mandate by the state, and that caused us to create a new process that we didn't have on the books. But the process we did create is based on one that currently exists.
Which entities were querying about it?
I'm sorry?
Which individuals or companies were asking about the process and if they could use it?
Well, we have, as you know, we've had larger projects come to the fore in the past, and people have looked at it and said, I wonder if rather than go through a rezone application, like, for example, we have the neighborhood mixed-use zone, rather than go to that application, maybe there's something in this that would allow us to jump straight to a development agreement and use a development agreement to modify the zoning. The problem with that is that the administrative development agreement cannot modify the zoning. That would be legislative. In Dakota Pacific's case, the zoning was already modified by the state. So the legislative action has already taken place. Therefore, all that is left is an administrative process. It's somewhat technical. I hope your listeners are not confused and bored by the whole affair, but it wasn't really an option available to anybody. So those people who have previously looked at potential rezones, they've likely dropped this idea and gone back to where their original plan was.
Fair enough. And really quickly, you chose Columbus Pacific Development. There's Summit County-based separate company from Dakota Pacific, despite the similarity in the name, for the Klein Dolly parcel. That's a county-owned piece of land next to Jeremy Ranch Elementary School, and they were proposing some level of housing and a new Basin Rec field house there. What's the next step now that you've given them the bid, so to speak? I know you have to negotiate.
And a fire station. Don't forget the fire station.
Very true.
Also part of the site plan. Since the announcement was made, all the teams making proposals were highly valued and extraordinarily good at what they proposed. The Columbus Pacific project won out at the council vote and opinion, as it were. So we've actually just instigated a sequence of weekly meetings, a subcommittee of the council, two members of the county council, the county manager and staff, that would be myself, and Jeff Jones from Economic Development, and Madeline McDonough, our housing director. So we're going to carry on. We've just had one meeting where we've started throwing open budgets and proposals and potential tweaks, and we're going to be discussing that for a few weeks at least, I suppose. And then we go back to the larger council for an approval on how we're going to move forward with the plan. So a sequence of weekly meetings going into place. It's time consuming, but very valuable.
Very good. And really quick, at the end here, Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute at the U there did release some data recently about how much everyone's population shrank or grew across the state. And I was looking with interest at the Summit County data. It looks like overall we shrank again. And that was the case in every municipality except Francis. Very slight. I know you and I have talked off and on about, you know, just the general debate around how many workers need to live up here and the instability if you have a lot of people commuting with a good job market in the Salt Lake Valley. Do you have a sense for how much shrinking we can, you know, accommodate basically until we get some pretty negative economic effects?
I from the purely economic side, Jeff Jones is probably the expert to talk to on this one, our economic director. But obviously, shrinking and growing populations, they are facts in themselves, but you need to look around the facts. So what does this correlate to? One, we might have a shrinking population base, a full-time resident population, but we have a growing workforce. So what does that mean? It means there's more cars on the road. It means there's more traffic. So if we're actually pushing people out, potentially, I'm not going to say this is true, but I believe it to be true, is that housing prices are rising so fast. Probably rental prices are rising so fast too. So if rents are increasing faster than housing prices, the people, if you're, you know, a young couple starting a family, you're looking to buy yourself a house, you can't afford a unit if, for example, an 80-year-old house in Hannaford just recently sold for over $650,000. That's going to be out of your reach. So you're going to be relocating to somewhere more affordable and, if necessary, commuting to work in Summit County. So there are consequences. It does, as you and I have talked about, Connor, you know, it creates an instability in the housing market. The question is whether there are, if there's a future instability in, for say, development or other forms of the economy, then will that, you know, trigger some form of catastrophic event? And by catastrophic, I mean a major change, not a disaster, but it would be a significant change. And then there are certain tipping points. So 200 people a year, plus or minus, is probably not a big deal, but it's something we should very definitely keep an eye on.
Yeah, and you know, when I look at this, a lot of the things you mentioned about, you know, housing market instability, all that, you commonly hear that from pro-housing folks locally. The other thing you hear from that sort of crew of people is that, you know, growth is inevitable. It's something that needs to be controlled and managed, but it is inevitable. I look at these shrinking, like these numbers that the population's shrinking, and it seems to point to that growth is a matter of policy. Like, it seems like the local governments here have managed to stop it somehow.
How about this? When we look at our resident population, compare it with what we look at something we call vacancy rates in the housing market. We say, well, an increasing number of our houses are vacant, but that's something of a misnomer. Are those houses empty, or are they being used for short-term rentals? And if they're being used for short-term rentals, we're actually getting busier in terms of the number of services, the number of people, the frequent visitors, the amount of traffic, the services being provided. So growth in terms of units being built might actually be slowing down, but the impact on those units we already have is actually creating a, you know, busier commute. There are more people on the roads for greater lengths of time. It's a pro and con. It's not really a very simple exercise. You could say, yes, policy has created a housing shortage, in which case that by its very nature will increase the cost of housing, which means those people who can't afford it will be forced to commute. That's a decision we make. If we don't build housing where the workers are, those workers will be driving to and from where they live. If we're okay with that, that's fine. If we don't like traffic, maybe we should do something about it.
All right. I've taken too much of your time. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Connor, pleasure. Thank you. Bye now.
That's Community Development Director Peter Barnes for Summit County, which is also a financial supporter of this station. North Summit Fire Chief Ben Nielsen on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. And I know everyone's excited for the 4th of July because they don't have to work. I'd imagine it's quite the opposite for you because of the pyrotechnics involved. How are you feeling ahead of the holiday?
Well, I think we were a little bit excited for the holiday, but a little bit nervous also. We've gotten some NOAA reports, weather reports back from the National Forest Service that are not looking optimal. An extra hot summer, maybe later on in the season, some monsoon rains, which might help. But then at the same time, we're chasing lightning strikes. So that could be a fun summer for us. I'm pretty busy. When I say that, I mean that sarcastically a little bit, but we'll have a busy summer.
Well, it already has been. I think you've got the most ignitions already in the season, a couple last week. You know, what are some of the fire restrictions that you've put in place when we see stage one restrictions implemented? What does that mean for people practically?
Yeah, timing on this. Let me kind of back up just a little bit. There's about two fire restrictions that are in place. So you have a level one restriction that Utah has just put in place. For the entire state of Utah, which is no open fires, no fireworks, no smoking, no welding, grinding, or torching, which we did actually have last week, a couple of, or I think one of those fires because of a welding or a grinding issue. And then no use of off-road vehicles for any internal combustion equipment. So in general, what that means is that we're just getting nervous and that there's a lot of fires going on and that our resources are tapped statewide. I do think up here we're doing better because we're starting to dry out. I think everybody's kind of seeing it. On the second restriction, so North Summit Fire District has decided to do a restriction all the way to October 31st. Timing-wise, ours will actually probably extend further than what the Utah Division of Forestry would want. But at the same time, I think it shows us that when we have six people on, we're overwhelmed pretty quickly when it comes to brush fires. It takes a lot of bodies to be able to put that out.
Yeah, and that restriction does ban fireworks, right? Do you have exceptions for Pioneer Day or the 4th of July?
Yeah, there is exceptions there for special events. So these shows, for example, that Hennifer puts on in our area, those are under a different ISC code, International Fire Code. And there's a lot of restrictions that go with those. Plus, we inspect all those, and we're actually prepared in advance where we stage apparatus and personnel in advance for those kind of events. So those are still allowed.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned at the council meeting last week, Colville has an exception as well. Hennifer is the other municipality in your jurisdiction. Could you explain how they cover, how they handle restrictions? Because when you ask the council for a certain type of fire restriction, you're just covering unincorporated Summit County, and the municipalities handle it themselves.
Correct. Yeah. So each municipality will handle it themselves. And we just are asking we asked the Division of Natural Forestry, or the Division of Forestry, rather, the state forester, so to speak, we recommended that they shut that down in those areas. Colville passed an ordinance for their city, and then Hennifer has something in their code that states essentially that if when the fire warden changes it to high risk, or those signs out that you see about, if they change to high, that then there's also a fire restriction. But now that the state has enacted theirs, I mean, there's really no point. Everybody's on the fire restriction now.
Yeah, and I know this is not exactly in your coverage area, but I was talking with a coworker who was under the impression there are some exceptions to that unimproved fire pit rule for the Uinta Mountains, because, you know, when you go up camping, you know, you like to make your own fire pit and everything. Is that your understanding as well? Or are there certain exceptions depending on where you are geographically in Summit County?
You know, that's a good question, because we're not in that, we don't cover that area. I would say that there's no exceptions. Regardless, I don't think that they want fires. There may be one for an open, like recreational fire or something like that in an approved pit. But I think the best person to ask would be the county fire warden.
Definitely. You know, what kind of issues do you see with your proximity to the Wyoming border, though? Because, you know, the fireworks are all for sale just across the state line.
Yeah, I think last week we had a fire that, you know, some youth were lighting fireworks off of one of the overpasses on I-80 coming from Evanston. And so what ends up happening is we have to take care of that. Luckily, about a year ago, I want to say, we were able to put an MOU in place with Uinta Fire, and we have a really good relationship with them. So anything that's close to the border, because it is a little bit easier for them to come downhill versus us going up with big, heavy trucks. They respond with us with mutual aid. And so we actually just tackle that together. And they've been actually really good this last week to help us out quite a bit.
Yeah, it is nice to see the mutual aid agreements that all the fire departments have in place. And I know you can't speak a whole lot to this because there are, you know, policies in place for public information on fires. But I did feel like it was worth mentioning you were in southern Utah for the Forsyth fire, and you talked a little bit about it last week to the county council. You know, why did you respond, and what did you see personally, I guess?
Yeah, we can definitely talk about what we saw, our experiences. I don't want to speak to the fire per se. They have PIOs and things like that, like you said. But for our experience, we get a phone call from our fire warden who says, hey, they're burning down structures and things like that, and they need some help. And so we just kind of called. We filled that call for help, essentially. We had some personnel that could go down there, including myself. We had time and then extra apparatus at the time to do that. So we sent that down. I think we did a really good job. There was no more structures that burned after we got there. There was about four or five Type 1 fire trucks that were down there protecting those, including Wasatch Fire, protecting those homes. Yeah, but, you know, it was pretty incredible. The winds were, I think they were about 50, 60, 70 miles per hour. So that fire was really, when we got down there the next afternoon, I want to say it was Saturday afternoon, they were really pushing hard. And that was when the big push broke through all the way to the other side of the mountain and continued on, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's tough to see. I think I saw it was lightning caused. So it goes back to what you said about monsoonal moisture, not really necessarily a big help.
Yeah, it does kind of wet things down a little bit, but those lightning strikes can kind of stick around for days at a time. And then once it does dry out again, then it reignites. It can be a big problem for us. So we chase those down usually every summer.
All right. Chief Nielsen, did you want to mention anything else ahead of the holiday or just any general tips for folks as they're staying fire-wise this summer?
No, I would just say with the weather and the conditions that we're having this summer, it's extra hot, extra wind, things like this, be really careful. Watch your children. Make sure that they're being observed, during the not playing with fires, not playing with fireworks. So I would just say overall safety, kind of keep an eye out for each other. And then if you see anything, definitely call it in and we'll go track it down and see if we can't help out on our end.
All right. North Summit Fire Chief Ben Nielsen, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you. Have a good day.
In studio with me is Program Director John Burdick, and on the phone is former Program Director Jan Williams. John and Jan, good morning and happy birthday to us.
Happy birthday, KPCW and KPCW listeners.
Yes, for sure. Happy birthday. Safety first.
Yes.
Yeah, no, we did the safety interview first, and now we can have a little bit of fun because long ago, 45 years ago, we first went on air. Was it on the 2nd?
It was. It was July 2nd, 1980. We don't feel a day over 39, really, but we are 45 years and going here at KPCW. Yep.
All right. And it's just been downhill from there. I mean, I gathered that y'all wanted to come on and talk about the changes that we've seen over the years. I mean, one thing that I always like to tell people about is we've kind of hopscotched around town a little bit.
Yes.
We're first in like the Park City Live building. You know, where have we been? Where have we been broadcasting from?
Jan, you want to take this one?
Oh, I don't even know what the building is now called. The old Memorial Building. Is that it? Park City Live?
Yeah.
It's funny, you can market to yourself depending on where you think it is, yeah. But it is
exactly.
The Memorial Building.
But local, yeah, currently everybody would know it at that. It used to be the Memorial Building. It was a big gymnasium. I think the police station was downstairs. And the studio was up the stairs, up the rafters, up the tiny, tiny little space of two rooms. And I'm not very tall, I had to duck to get in. And then if you wanted to check to see what was going on outside, rain, snow, sun, run down the rafters, run down the stairs, run outside, and run back up.
Yep, it was called the bunker. The broadcast bunker is what they called in the Veterans War Memorial Building at 427 Main Street, now the Marquee, formerly Harrio's, and then Park City Live. It's had a lot of iterations there, and that was in 1980, but The founding five, Blair Fulner, Dan Wilcox, Tom Brock, Jay Meehan, and Rebecca Weidenhouse had this crazy idea to get a radio station up here in Park City. One of the stories goes is that it was because of the weather, Jan, right? Nobody was giving the proper weather for up here.
It feels like it would be important
kids
for us
these days.
Now.
You've got it made. You've got windows. No kids.
Yeah, there's no open snow. And did we always broadcast? We haven't always broadcasted on the same frequencies, but I'm curious, like, how the listening area has expanded over the years.
Well, we started at 91.9, which we still broadcast in the Heber Valley, and that was our original signal. With Edna, was that the name of the?
Oh my gosh, I forgot about Edna. Yes.
Edna was the original broadcasting equipment that they scraped together from basically parts down in commercial radio stations down from Salt Lake City and hauled it up here. And Edna started kicking out July 2nd, 1980, to the greater Park City area, 91.9 FM. And then we went up to Lewis Peak and got 88.1, which you can hear on a clear day all the way in Evanston, Wyoming.
And I heard it in Morgan the other day, which was shocking to
yes.
me.
And she's still kicking out there. And then I think Larry expanded to 91.7 somewhere in the 2000s, maybe 2005, somewhere in there. But some
early 2000s, yeah.
Yep. And then, Jan, you started as a volunteer, is that right?
Yeah, in 82. And, you know, the early 80s in Park City, kind of a gray area. So 81, or I think it was the end of 81 into January of 82. So it was that winter that when I moved there. So, and radio was my background. So I was like, oh, you got this little station? Oh, you need some volunteers? Oh, okay, I'm in.
And then it was the Wild Wild West. What was your show about?
Oh, I think it kind of changed. Some people had, you know, this is what I'm going to do and this is all I'm going to play. And I think I was more of what's on your mind for the day. That's where we're going to go. It definitely was the Wild Wild West. Whatever records you had in your hand, you could bring up. And then, like you say, it was all bits and pieced together with records and equipment and tape. And then it grew into this fabulous thing. So I'm going to say it out loud. Thanks, Blair. Thanks, yeah. Susan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah,
yes.
You can't just play anything anymore. Programming rules with an iron fist. You've got must-play songs for the DJs and
so,
AAA
yeah.
music.
So, yeah, we went to a AAA format when Blair went to music and news and picked up NPR. And the affiliate station we started in 1992 as an affiliate NPR station carrying Morning Edition and NPR headlines at the top of every hour. And that's when we designated ourselves as a AAA radio station for the music portion of the show. And for those of you that don't know what Adult Album Alternative is, that's AAA radio. And there are a number of these stations across the country keeping consistent radio. There's consistency amongst AAA stations. And what you just mentioned are the songs that are played across the country on AAA stations. Mm-hmm. So we kind of keep that format going. But the DJs have a choice, and then we'll always bump something out of the playlist of the DJs for any listener requests, and that has always been the station's motto, I guess, of let's hear what Park City wants to hear. And then
exactly, that whole consistency thing came in as opposed to the Wild Wild West. And so KPCW grew up, it's like, oh, a little consistency. So everybody knew what they were getting, and now you know exactly what you get with KPCW. Whenever you listen, it's a fabulous thing.
Did they start with the Lost and Found? Because the Lost and Found, I think, is what mm-hmm. people tune in the most for, right?
Yeah,
which is at the bottom of the hour.
Maybe for utility, but also for entertainment value is what I hear around town.
Yep.
Oh, for sure. And the ride board. Hey, I need a ride to Salt Lake. Hey, I need a ride to Heber. Oh, okay, I'll meet you there Tuesday. I'll pick you up on Main Street. The ride board, Lost and Found, and the classified ads.
Those started
were
with
quite
the
unique.
Station. We had Lost and Found like in 1980.
Yeah, the ride board was key then to get down to Salt Lake City. So you
could get
just,
anywhere. Yes.
No Uber.
No Uber at that
no.
time. Yeah.
Bummer.
Oh my gosh.
It was KPCW
there was,
Uber. We should quote that term right there. You know?
There you go.
Well, we don't have a ton of time, but are you doing anything to celebrate today? You know, I think we're going to mentioning
things,
it throughout the day on
the
broadcast.
What we'd love to do is we have a new KPCW app, new reimagined app that announced now has a feature on there, says Tell KPCW. And we would love to hear the stories of all the listeners out there. So they can just get on their app and record a little voice memo. And for our birthday, we'll pull those together. And if we can, try to get them on air throughout this weekend for the holiday weekend that's coming up. And we will be featuring a float in the 4th of July parade. So we definitely want people to see us, and we're doing a little Lost and Found tribute with our float this year, so that'll be fun.
Nice. And I just want to say quickly, thank you to all the listeners for your continued support throughout all these decades.
Yes, and here's to the next 45 years.
Okay, I'm going to need a rocking chair.
Me too. All right, John and Jan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Happy birthday. Here in the studio with me is our DJ, Karen Bell, but now the founder of Kept Current and Kept Kind. The website went live this morning, you just said, before we were on air. This is exciting. Tell people a little bit about what this organization does.
Well, Kept Kind is a love letter to Park City, and really it's a campaign that I'm running that is really a weekend-long celebration of kindness and connection and community, and it's built entirely by locals for locals, and it takes place July 25th through 27th, but we are announcing it today, and it's made possible by Whedon Family Ranch, who is my presenting sponsor, and they are terrific, and basically we are just really taking all the things that we love about Park City and shining a light on them and trying to just focus on all the good juju that's around town.
Yeah, I was perusing the website today, and it seems like it's a place to find community events. But, you know, how broad is the mission?
So basically, Kept Kind is my website Kept Current is my website that really focuses on community events each week. It comes out, and it's really about the best things to do in Park City. It's curated, and it's pretty popular around town. But one of the things that I just started thinking about is our community values, and I just wanted to create a campaign that really focused on all the good we have here. We so often talk about all the issues that we have around town. We talk about, you know, how we're going to solve our problems with traffic and affordable housing and development, etc. But what we don't do often is really just intentionally focus on the things that brings us together and who we are as a town and those values and how they really bring us, you know, they're here. I'm not inventing anything, but what we don't do is really put a spotlight on that. So this campaign is really meant to be a weekend of just random acts of kindness that we all do for each other. And I'm not asking anybody to do anything that weekend. People just go about their business, and hopefully there'll be some kind of really nice thing that happens to them during the course of the weekend, a random act of kindness. So I have a bunch of volunteers that have been coming together, writing kindness notes, making little pieces of art that we'll leave around town. Maybe you'll go and check out a book at the library, and out falls like a really nice note that somebody in the community wrote for you. Businesses, you know, this is being fueled by businesses, so they're giving generously in-kind donations, and we'll
in-kind donations.
Yeah, so those will circulate back out into the community, and we just want to make somebody's day and make them smile. So that's what we're doing for a whole weekend, just shining a light on all the awesomeness that exists here in Park City and just trying to put some positivity out in the world.
Yeah, because like psychologists, gurus, everybody seems to agree, like at least when it comes to gratitude, for example, you got to remember and remind yourself about these things, because then you kind of forget and fall into these bad patterns. It's kind of trying to push against that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think kindness is intentional. You know, it comes naturally, I think. And I think in this town, it really comes. I think this town is so kind. I think the people are here. You know, I always say that most people say I came for the winter and stayed for the summer. And I always think about it that I came for the winter and I stayed for the people. Mm. And, you know, I've lived in a lot of towns, and this one is special. And I just think that kindness, community, connection, it's something that really brings us together. And I wanted people to be intentional about that and just focus on that for a weekend. So people can go to my website, find more information there about the campaign, more details. But really, it's just meant to intentionally shine a light on positivity for a whole weekend.
Yeah, and that's keptcurrent.com.
Kept Kind.
Oh, Kept Kind.
Yeah.
And the celebration will be, I have July 25th through 27th?
Correct.
All right.
And one last thing, if anybody wants to walk behind the banner of kindness in the 4th of July parade, go to keptkind.com and you can sign up to walk with us.
All right. Sounds good. We've been speaking with DJ Karen Bell. Anything else you want to mention?
Yeah.
A reminder for folks to, you know, have a good day and pay it forward?
Again, if you go to the website, you can sign up for volunteer days or to walk, and that would be awesome. It's co-created with the community. We've had over 50 volunteers come and help put this campaign together.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you for tuning in to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.